It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The federal tax reform measure passed nearly a year ago included an overshadowed provision that's enabling states to designate certain areas as opportunity zones in order to ease blight and eliminate poverty in distressed communities through tax incentives given to businesses. I spoke with Pennsylvania's Secretary of Community and Economic Development, Dennis Davin, on his recent visit about how disadvantaged communities in the Pittsburgh area might benefit from the opportunity zones.
Secretary Davin, what has Pennsylvania been doing since then to sort of take advantage of this program?
So the first thing that we had to do is the governor had to nominate which opportunity zones within the state of Pennsylvania, the Commonwealth. So there are 1,200 eligible districts, census tracts that are eligible, and we were able to nominate 25% of those. So it's 300 roughly. So we did that. We worked with all the different communities throughout the Commonwealth. We looked at areas where we thought had the best opportunity for engagement and opportunities for development within those opportunity zones, and again worked with elected officials and others to select the 300 and sent those to the feds. They agreed and approved. We have the areas that are nominated as federal opportunity zones in Pennsylvania, and we have that on our website. The other thing is that the feds are coming up with regulations, and it's been kind of a slow process, to be honest with you. They just came out at the end of October with their first tranche of regulations to give some direction to organizations that want to create these opportunity funds to be able to invest in these communities. And there's another set of regulations coming out by the end of this year, and then by mid-next year, maybe even more after that. So they've been kind of coming out in drips and drabs. But what we're doing is we are going to organize events in each region of the state to go over what we know right now. So we'll get subject matter experts. We will also work with the folks in our department to look at other funding that we could put together and programs that would be able to help communities utilize these opportunity zones to the best of their ability.
What was the criteria used to go from the 1,200 eligible to the 300 that were nominated?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the criteria was looking at areas, first of all, that we felt had the ability to have investments in those areas to take advantage of them. And frankly, there are some areas that won't see that type of investment. They have to be investment-grade quality projects that are in those areas. So we felt that the areas that we ended up selecting had those opportunities. We also wanted to work with the local officials, and that's important for us because the folks that are here on the ground know better than anybody what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. So we took that into consideration in making the decision to finally decide on the 300 that eventually were sent to the federal government.
The 300 that were sent, what were the qualifying factors they needed to be eligible, though, to participate?
So it was part of the 1,200 had to be eligible as census tracts. So that was a federal designation based upon a number of criteria, poverty and things like that. The 300 of the 1,200, obviously, they qualified under the federal criteria. From our perspective, it was a little more subjective because, you know, you have places that in the Pittsburgh region that had the ability to attract investment-grade projects, and that's what we were looking for. But also working with the communities to see where they wanted investment, where they thought they had the best opportunities. And frankly, I can't remember the exact amount in Pittsburgh, but we selected probably half of what was submitted. But we selected the ones that we felt gave us the best option, and ultimately the elected officials and community organizations agreed with what we did.
Based on poverty rates and income?
Well, that was, yeah, exactly. Based on all of that, that had to be part of the criteria for the feds. But here it's more based upon what areas really had the opportunities to utilize the opportunity zone funding. Where would, in other words, if a PNC bank is developing an opportunity zone fund, where would they make that investment? What would make sense?
Now, do they include whole neighborhoods, parts of neighborhoods? What's involved there?
So they're census tracts. So census tracts aren't necessarily whole neighborhoods. And so the census tracts are, again, a designation that every state in the country has. So it gives a little more flexibility when you're looking at providing funding. So, for example, community development block grant funds. So there are certain census tracts that you can utilize, like, for example, community development block grant funds in because of the poverty levels, the level of dilapidated housing, and a variety of other criteria that the federal government requires. So it's similar to that. So it's not necessarily whole neighborhoods or counties or cities or whatever, but it's a smaller designation within those areas.
Is it easier when some of these tracts, some of these zones are near or are part of urban areas, part of population centers? What about, are there any zones planned for more rural or suburban areas?
Absolutely. You know, and one of the things that we wanted to be very, the governor was very sensitive to, is that you could have put all 300 zones in the city of Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, and there was no way we were going to do that. So we wanted to be geographically prudent about that and make sure that we connected with other areas that had opportunities. So there are urban areas. There are areas that are outside of the city of Pittsburgh, Allegheny County, that we think have some opportunities. But frankly, I mean, there are going to be other areas in the 300 we selected that might not see opportunities. Again, everything depends upon where the regulations finally end up. But we think that, you know, some of the a lot of the areas really have the opportunity to get some pretty meaningful investments. But the reality is that there may be some areas that are not going to get that, too. And the thing about this is over the next few years, you've seen it happen in Pittsburgh. Lawrenceville is bursting at the seams, and that wasn't the case 10 years ago. So there are these areas that East Liberty, Larimer, there are these areas that are really starting to identify themselves differently, and you're going to see that over the course of the next few years too. So we need to be nimble about that as much as possible.
What's your sense of how it's going to work? Where's the money going to come from, and how is it going to be utilized?
So there are trillions of dollars in opportunities here. So it's based upon the opportunity to utilize capital gains that are out there. So in a lot of cases, the capital gains that an organization may take just get invested back in because they don't want to have those realized capital gains and pay taxes on them. This is an opportunity to utilize that ability to provide essentially a credit to those capital gains. And take that money that's utilized and put that to good use in areas that really need it. And that's really the genesis of the program. And I think it was bipartisan in the House. And the issue that we see is that, again, they want to make sure the Department of Treasury and also Commerce want to make sure this is done the right way, but they're taking their time about it. So it's a little frustrating for us only because, you know, we've seen for the past 20 years the level of community development block grant funding going down further and further and further, which is hurting the communities that need it the most. So it's hurting, for example, in the city of Pittsburgh, the Urban Redevelopment Authority being able to fund projects in certain areas because projects that really need the help, or tearing down housing and things like that. These opportunity zones, I think people really understood that this was a good potential funding source to really make up some of the difference that the CDBG funds used to do. And that's what we think. That I'm part of an organization of state economic development officials, and this is number one on our agenda to discuss, get folks from Treasury and Commerce to really give us, you know, I don't want to say put pressure on them, but just to tell them, look, we really need this to roll out quicker. This has to get going as quickly as possible.
So, in essence, it's a voluntary investment rather than here are the taxes, they go into the government, and they carve out a certain pool of funds to invest in getting rid of or helping to eliminate these issues, including blight.
Exactly. So it's really based upon, I think the feds came out initially thinking that this was going to be for, you know, the development of a building, a commercial office building, maybe in an area that had some level of disinvestment and other things. That was really kind of the idea behind it. But we think that there are so many other things that this can do, you know, to really help these communities get back on their feet. The one thing we don't want to see with a program like this is gentrification, for example, which could happen, and we're seeing in certain areas of our biggest cities in Pennsylvania, but it's really happening all throughout the country. And that's not what anybody wants, and that's not what we desire for this particular program. We're going to work hard to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Is there any match required?
For these, no. No, there's no match required. But again, not all the regulations have come out. You know, so the bottom line is that as it's designed right now, these funds won't provide 100% of the funding that's needed. There'll be probably a capital stack that'll include equity, that'll include other public financing, you know, through programs that we have and maybe the Urban Redevelopment Authority has. So it'll be a variety of different programs that'll come together to make these projects work.
You came to Pittsburgh to talk about this topic, the opportunity zones, and you were meeting with some leaders in the north side because there are zones in the north side. What did you get from what the leaders in this community, in the north side community, want to do and how these opportunity zones can help?
So I think in Northside's a great example because, again, my background is I was director of housing for the Urban Redevelopment Authority and worked for Allegheny County as economic development director. So I got to see firsthand the north side and how it's developed over the course of the past 30 years. But to see the level of activity, and it's not just the sports facilities and things like that, but the riverfront development, Manchester be developed, the federal north area, Allegheny General Hospital, and other areas. We think that there are great opportunities to further develop that. I'm a big proponent of, you know, you working from the strengths. And the north side has these incredible strengths that there's beautiful communities, Deutschtown, East Allegheny, that really need continued investment. And that's what these funds can help do.
Specifically housing, other elements?
Housing, commercial development, maybe retail development. Until all of the criteria comes out and the regulations come out in full, we won't know exactly. But that's kind of the thought behind it right now.
When do you hope that you'll be actually see some of the fruits of this program?
That's a great question. I am hoping that it's going to be 2019. I'm hoping. I don't know that that's realistic, though.
Dennis Davin is the Secretary of the Pennsylvania Department of Community and Economic Development. Secretary Davin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Looking for a thoughtful gift for the guitar player in your life? Well, if you want one with plenty of history built into it, you'll have to shell out some serious cash. The list of the top 10 most expensive guitars sold at auction features three owned by Eric Clapton, two built for Jerry Garcia, and one that Bob Dylan never came to pick up. A certain Fender Stratocaster that Dylan played at the Newport Folk Festival in 1965, you know, the electric guitar that had all the folk fans outraged? It sold at auction 5 years ago today for a whopping $965,000 after spending the previous five decades with the family of Dylan's former personal pilot. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Long-lost paintings and drawings by a noted local artist are part of a new gallery exhibit. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll has the story of newly rediscovered works by the late Irma Freeman.
Irma Freeman was born in Germany. She was my grandmother. She was born in 1903, and she died in 1994.
That's artist and educator Sheila Ali. She grew up in Shadyside. The family didn't have much money, but it bonded through art.
We all drew and sketched around as a family with my grandmother, with each other, or wherever we went.
Ali and her siblings adored their grandmother, a prolific self-taught artist.
I mean, when I think about the way she was when she was in her 90s, she painted from morning till night.
In 2009, Ali founded an art center in Friendship and named it for her grandmother, the Irma Freeman Center for Imagination.
She was one of the most inspired people I've ever met.
Freeman actually made most of her paintings after age 70 and showed them publicly only after turning 80. When she died, nearly 25 years ago, she left behind some 500 colorful, lively landscapes, portraits, and still lifes, ranging from straightforward to more impressionistic. Freeman's work isn't much known outside Pittsburgh, but she has her fans.
When you see an Irma Freeman, you'll say, that's her style.
Pat McCardle is a Pittsburgh-based collector.
When you see the figurative work and these colorations that she uses, it's unique to her.
Sheila Ali, Freeman's granddaughter, archives the paintings. But in May, she learned she didn't have all of them.
This lady wrote me an email
she found a bunch of stuff. She said it was either in the trash or in her basement, and it had Ruth Freeman and Irma Freeman's name on it.
Ruth Freeman is Irma's daughter, herself an artist, age 78. And so one day in July, Ruth and Ali piled into Ali's car in Shadyside, joined by Ali's brother, Robbie Ali. They headed for a Bloomfield address.
Just let's see how it goes. We have no clear idea of what we will find.
Their destination was minutes away.
The hidden treasure.
They arrived at a small apartment building.
Come on in.
Hi, I'm Ruth.
Hi, straight ahead.
Donna Palermo moved into the South Aiken Street apartment in January. One rainy day in May, she walked by the building's trash pickup and saw a pile of artworks on paper.
This was the one that really caught my eye because these were all kind of stuck together and not in a bag or anything. So I brought it and I'm like, wow, that's really close.
What was close was the address written on the back of one artwork on Ellsworth Avenue, a building where Ruth Freeman once lived. Palermo went online, searched Irma Freeman, and found the Irma Freeman Center.
That's really nice of you.
I'm not looking for anything out of it. It's something that I felt should get back to the family.
A stack of unframed paintings and drawings sits on Palermo's kitchen table. The room smells a little musty as the family sifts through the papers.
Yeah, these are real old.
Let's take a look at this.
That's real old. This is from Carnegie Mellon. And I went to school there.
Ruth Freeman graduated from Peabody High School in 1957, then studied art at Carnegie Tech, later Carnegie Mellon University. Irma, her mother, sometimes sat in on her classes. Most of the works here are Ruth's, but suddenly they find a colorful pastel portrait of a seated woman.
Wait a second, this looks like an Irma
Freeman. Yeah, that's hers. That's definitely hers.
Oh, there's her signature and a date.
Yeah, I know.
64.
Let me take a picture.
1964.
In all, Palermo rescued 50 works from the trash. The oldest was a teenage Ruth's urban landscape of the old East Liberty Sears department store from 1957. Still, there's a mystery.
I don't understand how they got in the trash.
The building's landlord says the artworks were in the basement when he bought it in a tax sale in 1997. He says the art was thrown out by accident. Sheila Ali thinks Ruth left the artworks behind at a different apartment in the 80s and that they migrated here with an old roommate. Another question remained.
We have this big pile of art now. What are we going to do with it?
Sheila's brother had an idea.
Sheila, what do you think about doing an exhibit of just these? Wouldn't that be cool?
Something like that is happening. The exhibit Impressions and Found Work features paintings by Irma Freeman, including six rediscovered works at the Irma Freeman Center. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
The show opens with a reception Friday. You're listening to The Confluence.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. It's time for the annual return of the Holiday Hootenanny. The event, happening tonight at the August Wilson Center, is put together by WESA's sister station, WYEP, and puts homegrown artists in the spotlight for a night of festive fun. Joining me for a preview of the annual holiday concert is WYEP digital content manager and evening mix host, Cindy House. Welcome, Cindy.
Hi, thanks, Megan. Thanks for having me.
Cindy, for the poor souls who've never experienced the night of magic of a Holiday Hootenanny, what are they in store for tonight?
It's a night of holiday music, traditional and not so traditional, performed by some of the area's best musicians. We have a house band that is led by the fabulous Nathan Zub, who is in a band called Recluse, and also Addie Twig, who's in a band called The Telephone Line. It's very rock-oriented in terms of music genre, but we do have a couple of different sounds this year, which I'm pretty excited about. We've got some hip-hop, and we've got some Brazilian music in the set this year. But it's and also soul and blues, and it's just going to be a blast.
And a return to the August Wilson Center this year. What time do the festivities begin?
So the doors open at 6. The music starts at 7 o'clock. And then there's an after party in the lobby. Selecta will be there, who hosts our Grand Groove Radio on Friday evenings. He'll be there spinning the tunes, working the decks.
The bar reopens for the after party. What else can people expect? There's a couple of new features this year, right?
Yeah, there's always fun times at the Holiday Hootenanny. There is a scavenger hunt that will be pretty interesting. There's
any
also,
hints for that?
I can't really reveal that right now, Megan, but thanks for asking.
Hey, you gotta try.
Also, we will have a photo booth available, which is, you know, a party is not complete without one.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's a David Bowie Santa Claus.
Yes, Bowie Claus.
Excellent.
And Bowie Claus will be there making an appearance in the lobby and on stage.
Available for photo opportunities?
Of course.
Awesome. And if you are still on the fence, Cindy, where can the people find more information?
Well, you can go to our website, wyep.org/hoot18.
Tickets are still available. You can get them at the door for $35 each. Proceeds will be donated to the Tree of Life Synagogue Fund. Cindy, I'll see you tonight.
See ya. Thanks.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There are thousands and thousands of bridges, big and small, in Pennsylvania, and a large percentage of them are always in need of replacement or at least repairs. For the last 4 years, the State Department of Transportation has used what it calls a rapid bridge replacement project to do just that, replacing some ailing bridges quickly. The project is nearing its end, so what did we learn? On the line from Harrisburg is Mike Bonini, who leads this project for PennDOT. Mike, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And in studio is Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Ed Blazina, who covers transportation. Ed, welcome back to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
Mike, this project, PennDOT's, I believe, first public-private partnership, certainly of this magnitude. Logistically, how did that help smooth the overall process?
Well, as you mentioned, our rapid bridge replacement project is definitely our largest and most complex public-private partnership project that we've initiated here in Pennsylvania. Through this project alone, we're going to be investing over $900 million in our transportation network to replace 558 poor bridges. So for a lot of different reasons, this rapid bridge replacement project is seen as a game changer both here in Pennsylvania and in nationally. It's the first multi-asset, multi-location P3 project of its kind in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Now, you used the term poor. Let's get right to that. What do you mean by poor? We've heard more technical descriptions are used nationwide, like structurally deficient, functionally obsolete. But what does PennDOT mean by the word poor?
It's terminology that's been handed down to us from the Federal Highway Administration. In effect, we don't refer to bridges as structurally deficient anymore. We just refer to them as good or poor.
Okay. So what does that mean? What kind of shape are these in when it comes to poor?
Well, so when we started the project, and even to date, we've been challenged with an aging, poor condition bridge inventory and limited funding and resources. So this public-private partnership approach allows the department to complement our traditional bridge delivery program with a partnership effort to replace 558 of these bridges across the state while minimizing impact on motorists.
Mm-hmm. So one more for you right now, Mike, and that is you decided 558 bridges need help. What came next? How did your partners get involved from the private sector? What did the work entail?
So the department went through a competitive procurement to identify a private partner. And in this case, our rapid bridge replacement project provides for that private entity, Plenary Walsh Keystone Partners, to lead the efforts on our design, construction, and then ultimately the maintenance of these 558 bridges across the state. So tasked with delivering this $900 million design and construction contract, Plenary Walsh Keystone Partners is responsible for financing, designing, constructing, and then maintaining those bridges for a 25-year period beyond completion. Our responsibilities at the Department of Transportation are to provide for routine maintenance such as snow plowing, debris removal, and incident first response.
Okay. Let's bring reporter from the Post-Gazette, Ed Blazina, in. Ed, you've been to some of these construction sites. What have you seen? Has it looked any different from other construction sites when it comes to bridges?
What's unique about this is that a lot of these bridges were very similar in size. The idea was to get an economy of scale by getting a bunch of bridges relatively the same size. You could get pre-made, precast concrete pieces and use them all over the place. Mm-hmm. That was the goal, was to make the design and the construction as easy as possible, almost like putting together a jigsaw puzzle.
Mm-hmm. So you were at these sites. Does it look like things were moving faster or what? I know it's hard to judge on a day-to-day basis.
Yes, they were moving faster because they were using pieces that were made basically to come in and drop them in place.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a complicated process, but the idea was for the contractor to be able to do this 558 times on very similar bridges. They get better at it as they go along.
So both to Mike and to Ed, so really, was it rapid? Did the work happen quickly, Mike?
Yes, and just I'll give you some numbers to put it into perspective. To date, 515 of the 558 bridges have been constructed and are open to the traveling public, and that's 92% of the program. There are another 38 bridges that are currently under construction, and we anticipate that a majority of those will actually finish their construction and be open to the traveling public by the end of this calendar year or the end of this month. So that's going to leave a small handful that will roll into 2019. But just to keep it into perspective, 92% of the bridges are currently open to traffic, and another 38 are currently under construction. And when you just add those two numbers together, that's 99% of the program. So from a delivery standpoint, over a four-year construction period, it has been successful. The other thing to note on an individual bridge-by-bridge basis is that the agreement is designed to incentivize the rapid construction of these bridges, and that there are penalties in effect for bridges that aren't open within a contractual time frame.
So are penalties going into place because, as you said, there's still a few dozen need to be completed? Are there penalties going to happen against the contractor?
No, not at this time. And the reason for that is the department fully anticipated this project coming to completion by the end of this calendar year, 2018. The issue that we were faced with in the last year of construction were significant weather issues that impacted the schedule, as well as utility relocation delays that were caused in part by the times that utilities have to send crews elsewhere along the eastern seaboard to deal with destructive storms.
Right.
So the contract always allowed for relief events to be granted to the contractor when it wasn't their particular issue, and weather and utility delays are delays that are permissible, and you know, they've also done as much as they can to, again, build these bridges as quickly as possible.
Right. Ed, you reported on another holdup that was not weather-related that happened, I believe, last year. What did that involve?
Part of what happened is this project was so massive that it strained the industry that provides the precast concrete beams. Plenary Walsh literally had to try to get additional companies certified to meet state standards to provide those beams because there weren't enough available. They also ran into some other difficulties that I guess could have been anticipated, but you wouldn't necessarily think of. Trout season is a big deal.
Trout season, you said?
Yes. I was up at a bridge site in Lawrence County where the construction had been delayed for several months because they had to wait until trout season was over. They couldn't disturb the habitat during fishing season.
Oh, wow. So Ed brings up an interesting point there, Mike, about, so they're designed, and so one of the ideas behind having a single contractor or the engineers designing similar bridges, that speeds up the process. But what did you learn about, wow, we've got to have all this product ready to go because we have these similar designs? What did you learn from that?
There have been a number of lessons that the department and the industry have learned to date through the delivery of these 558 bridges. As I mentioned, I mean, this is a massive project, and it's just as much a logistics project as it is a bridge construction and ultimate maintenance contract. So the first thing that we have recognized is that a strong project team and protocol is essential. The department and our partners at Plenary Walsh Keystone Partners have developed a multi-discipline team that combines experts not only from our central office here in Harrisburg, but all of our 11 engineering districts. We've also deployed a construction quality assurance team that works with Plenary Walsh Keystone Partners to ensure that quality expectations are met on every project. And we're using as much technology as we can to help visualize the project, manage the project, track progress, and even identify any slips in the project schedule.
Mike, the 558 bridges that you mentioned, do they span the Commonwealth? Or is there a concentrated number in certain portions of the state?
They do span the Commonwealth. All of the bridges, and it's probably important to note that these are really designed to replace bridges in more rural locations of the of Pennsylvania, of the Commonwealth. So, for instance, the city of Pittsburgh proper and the city of Philadelphia don't have any bridges necessarily included in it, but the rest of the state does. Heavy concentration in southwestern Pennsylvania as well as northeastern Pennsylvania, but there are projects in every, I think, 66 of the 67 counties throughout the state.
Hmm. So here in the Pittsburgh area, we tend to think of the larger bridges, those that carry tens of thousands of people and vehicles a day, Liberty Bridge, Fort Pitt Bridge, et cetera. So to both of you, and I'll start with Ed, how do these smaller bridges in the rural areas that Mike mentioned, how do they compare and in terms of importance to the people who use them? Ed?
They're critically important. They may only carry 3,000 or 5,000 vehicles a day, but those are vehicles that are providing access to farmland for farmers to move their product to market and get equipment into their territories that they need. So they are critical to these folks. And part of the way this was done is some of these bridges were literally constructed. They were designed in advance and constructed in 30 to 60 days.
That fast?
That fast.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So, Mike, I want you to follow up on that about the rural areas, because let's face it, if a bridge is shut down or limited traffic in a city, there are generally a few detours, a few alternate routes that motorists can take. But sometimes those options are limited and lengthy for the people who rely on these bridges in the rural areas, are they not?
That's absolutely correct. And without this program that's addressing these 558 bridges in the more rural parts of our state, we would have been faced with potentially additional bridge postings with weight limits or closures. And then ultimately, and as Ed mentioned, that really plays havoc with communities' mobility, school buses, emergency vehicles, delivery vehicles, and others would be sent on long detours as a result of that particular bridge either being posted or closed. So that's really the focus of this, is to construct new bridges in these rural areas so that the communities and can benefit from the delivery.
Ed, when you were on site, you said in Lawrence County?
Yes.
Okay. Did you get a chance to talk to anybody who would be affected? Were you just observing the construction?
Mostly I was observing the construction, but I did talk with the county commissioner up there,
right,
Dan Vogler. They had six bridges that were done just a year ago in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
And it was vitally important for that community to have those bridges done.
So, Mike, what would have happened if you didn't have this private partner, private-public partnership? Would these bridges have eventually gotten done? Any idea of how to project when they would have gotten done?
We've estimated or calculated that it would have taken about 8 to 12 years for these particular bridges to to have funding identified and for them to be included on transportation improvement programs for them to ultimately have been replaced. So the benefit of this P3 or public-private partnership is not only that these bridges have been constructed faster, but that we also now have the benefit of having a private partner, Plenary Walsh Keystone Partners, ultimately maintain these structures for a 25-year period. And that gives us the ability to focus resources, both financial and human, on our other transportation needs.
Mike, something I should have asked you when we talked previously and I didn't is, what's the guarantee for Plenary Walsh? Did they have to put up bond for 25 years to cover the cost, or how are we sure they're going to be around in 25 years?
They did, and there are performance metrics that are tied to the delivery of bridges. So at the onset of the project back in 2014, the department provided a one-time mobilization payment. Through the design and construction phases of the project, the state is providing 6 milestone payments as bridges are built and come online. And then throughout the lifespan of the agreement, the state provides availability payments, which are tied to performance metrics, and that is the bridges that are constructed, open to traffic, and ultimately accepted by the department.
So I want to ask you, we have just a couple minutes left. So what is going to happen in the new year with the remaining bridges of part of the 558 originally under this project? Mike?
The bridges that have not been constructed to date, or that the bridges that have not had their construction completed in 2018, they'll wrap up in the early part of 2019, and there are 5 bridges that have yet to be constructed. Those bridges will be built throughout the first 3 quarters of 2019, and then ultimately for the traveling public, they'll see nothing but 558 newly constructed bridges. We'll then work with our private partner, Plenary Walsh, to make sure that they are maintaining these structures, not only in 2019, but for the next 25 years through 2043.
And very briefly, Ed, I wanted to ask you, what have you learned from covering this project? I mean, you cover all sort of transportation issues. What have you learned from covering it from the outside about whether it's the rapid replacement or the private-public partnerships or what?
I think what's interesting is the way this project was designed to encompass the same size bridges. It's not something that will work all the time, but they were able to make almost a cookie-cutter approach to maintaining roads, which is very different than what happens ordinarily.
So, Mike, I want to ask you finally and briefly in our last minute, are there other potential opportunities for the P3 model in the works, whether it's bridges or other infrastructure, water, sewer, anything?
The short answer is yes. The department actually right now has a call for unsolicited proposals from private industry, where private industry has the ability to submit proposals to the department for consideration to help us either construct or maintain our existing transportation infrastructure. As long as those ideas are in the transportation realm, be they roads and highways or multimodal needs or trails or lighting or anything associated with the delivery of our transportation infrastructure, we do have a request out through the end of the calendar year for unsolicited proposals. Additional details can be found on the department's website.
All right. And very, very briefly, as revenue generation changes for transportation, is there a way to shift the burden of the rapid bridge replacement and other infrastructure upgrades elsewhere so we're not so heavily reliant on gas taxes? I just have 15, 20 seconds for you.
Well, as you know, the department maintains a vast and aging network of roadway and bridges. So any additional funding that could come in, we're fortunate here in the state to have Act 89 passed, but if federal legislation would be passed to increase the amount of funding available to the Commonwealth, we would try to take as best advantage of it as possible.
All right. Mike Bonini is the head of PennDOT's public-private partnership. He oversees the Rapid Bridge Replacement Project. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Ed Blazina covers transportation. Thanks to both of you. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stinelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.